Good evening. All right, please turn in your Bibles to Daniel 2. And as you get there, let me just remind you of a couple things. There are still books on the table. I'd really like to leave with as few as possible. If you decide to purchase a book or a t-shirt, please know that all those monies do go to support the ministry. Appreciate that. And I have less weight to carry home. So I would love, I'm speaking at Calvary Baptist Wisconsin Rapids tomorrow. Not Grand Rapids, that would be an awful drive. Michigan is what I was thinking. So I'd love to be able to tell them, I'm sorry, Emmanuel, clean me out. So, also I put out some more bookmarks for you. I have lots of those. Please take as many as you like. And when I was explaining our ministry initiatives, I didn't tell you about the gap year idea last night, did I? I forgot about that. Yeah. The board and I have talked about how we can have a greater influence in the lives of students. Right now, the influence we have is broad, but we want it to be deeper. I have to be careful how I approach students, and I basically have to wait for them to come to me. I'm okay with that, but we want to do something else. And so I have a dream, I have a vision of starting a program that we're right now just calling the Addison's Walk Student Fellows Program, where it would be a gap year, where we would invite students a year between high school and college to come spend 12 months with us, 9-12 months with us, and we will teach them how to think. I'm serious. What we will do, we will have a curriculum that will be literature, philosophy, ethics, logic, history, maybe Greek in there, and you might be surprised, but the plan would not be to have any official Bible or theology classes. But all those other things that we will do will be deeply immersed in Christian theology. Deeply immersed. I told you I went to Bible college, and way back, well, the earth was still cooling down when I went to Bible college. I had some credits that I wanted to transfer in from the community college I went to for a little bit, and they didn't transfer. And the reasoning was, well, because what you studied there wasn't centered on Christian doctrine, and so therefore it doesn't transfer. And I get that, but then when we had classes where the only connection to Christianity we had was when you pray before a class, that doesn't cut it. And I'm not saying that was the entirety of my education at all. But things that we should have been making a very significant connection, like literature. The redemptive story arc in literature is everywhere. It's unavoidable. So if you have questions about that, come talk to me. I'd love to tell you about that. Right now, we have no way to do that. But there is a multifamily dwelling, an old Victorian house, three blocks from my house, 7,000 square feet, $300,000. And it's been on the market for a year and a half. We could probably get it for a lot less than that. So this would be a residential program, students living in community, reading, writing, and discussing their faces off, all to the glory of God, so that we can turn them loose in the university so that they can have, guess what, a high-profile public witness for God in a hostile environment. So I would just ask for your prayers that God would give us wisdom and the resources to be able to get that done. All right, we are in Daniel chapter 2. We have looked at three fundamental questions that every worldview answers thus far. We've asked who or what is behind human history, and we looked at the ramifications of that answer. We have asked the question, what is really real or what is absolute? And we spent some time looking at the lives of Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar, and how they dealt with that very same issue. And then last night we looked at true identity. And we, I think, were left, hopefully I challenged all of us, me included, to be a people who do not give ground. We do not give at all when the enemy says, just surrender a little and I'll let you keep what you want. Nothing. We must be a people whose identity is wrapped up in the person of Jesus Christ. We must be a people whose identity is wrapped up in the person of Jesus Christ. For when we are put on the world stage and our faith is put to the test, to whom do you cling? In what do you find meaning? Tonight we're going to answer the question, do you have access to the supernatural? This is not the same question as, are you a spiritual person? There's actually only one answer to that question. Although somebody may say no, they're just wrong. They are spiritual people. Even people who would say, no, I adamantly do not believe in God. You will rarely find a person who says that they adamantly do not believe in God would say that they also do not believe in right or wrong, or believe in other metaphysical things like justice, love, mercy, consciousness, other things that are real that we cannot feel, have, taste, or touch. But they're very real, are they not? So just by confessing that they understand that those things exist in a tacit way is admitting that they are indeed spiritual beings. Well, as probably most, if not all of us in this room would understand, that every human being on the planet is indeed a spiritual being. In fact, as I said Sunday morning, sometimes we confuse that language, and we'll see somebody who is we would use language I would use from when I was in high school. Oh, that person is really on fire for God. Like they're the one who go off to Camp Fairwood, right? One of my favorite places on the planet. Best camp food ever. Right? I know. Sorry. It just took me back to a turkey dinner I had there once. It was really good. They make their own bread, for Pete's sake. But they have a really good speaker, and that kid's decisions last beyond coming home Saturday afternoon. Say, oh, they're really on fire for God. They're really spiritual. Well, the fact of the matter is, you can't be any more spiritual than you are. You can be more godly than you are, but you can't be any more spiritual than you are. You are a spiritual being. It'd be like saying, I wish I was my material body was more physical than it is. Well, no, it's material, it's physical, that's all there is to it. Now, you may have less physicality than you want, and I'm nearing 50, so I get that. But we're dealing with that question. So let me remind you, as we get into Daniel 2, what is at stake? Daniel and his friends, the big deal with them is not maintaining a private faith in God. That's not the big deal. The big deal is that they maintained a high-profile public witness for God in a hostile environment. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to be looking at Daniel chapter 2, and we're going to be going through verse 28. Now, if your Bible is set up anything like mine, you may have a heading over Daniel 2, which, by the way, is not inspired, over Daniel 2, and it may say something about Nebuchadnezzar's dream or the dream of the great man. Bible? Okay. And I'm sure that there are people in this room who really appreciate a good message on prophecy. This is not it. Okay? So we're not even getting to the interpretation of the dream. Okay? So if you're going to be mad and disappointed, do it now. But we're not even going to get there. And what we're going to do is we're going to walk through the passage and we're going to make a hard stop. And we are going to take a tour of the University of Babylon. I'm going to talk to you about how it was built. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the literature that Daniel and his friends studied. And I want you to see in blue and white the difference between what they held as young Hebrew men and what they were up against, so that we can put ourselves into their sandals, if you will, and we can really understand as best we can in our last evening together how hostile indeed this environment was. All right? Okay. So, here we go. Daniel chapter 2, verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. So, we've already seen that already, have we not? So, pop quiz. What chapter in Daniel have we looked at? Another dream of Nebuchadnezzar. 4. Thank you. Gold star for you. Well done. Right? So we've already looked at his dream in chapter 4. And we talked about how we know from just Old Testament, a simple reading of Old Testament and Old Testament history, that other Old Testament despots had dreams and concerned them, i.e. Pharaoh and skinny cows. And who wouldn't be freaked out by that? So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers. He summons his A-team. He wants the wizards, right? So he calls up the chair of the Hogwarts school there, and he says, all right, send over your best, because I need them to tell me what is going on in this dream. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means. Again, in my study, I'm quite certain that was the tone in which he used. Joke. Then the astrologers answered the king. May the king live forever. Now, that's a good way to start. When you are called in because the biggest, baddest dude on the planet, who happens to be your boss, calls you in and is going to tell you that he's told you he's had a dream and he wants to know what it means, you start off by complimenting him. Makes sense, right? So it's good to speak to the troubled king whose Ambien is not working to kind of get on his good side. And then they say this. This is really wise or sneaky, perhaps, on their part. Tell your servants the dream and we will interpret it. Now, remember on Sunday night, we said one of the things that we have to get on the table and talk about is that we tend to lose the shock and awe of biblical narrative that we have familiarity with. Remember that? I want you to keep that in your mind as we walk through this, because we're like, blah, 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 yeah, yeah, yeah. Couldn't tell the dream. Let's just get on to the important bits, the head of gold and all that kind of stuff. Well, wait, just hold on. So he tells him, guys, I had a dream. It's keeping me awake. You need to tell me what it means. Well, he said, well, how about you tell us what you dreamt? That would be really helpful to us in our interpretation of your dream. Makes sense, right? Verse 5. The king replied to the astrologers, this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and have your houses turned into piles of rubble. There is his favorite altar call. Does it again at the end of the next chapter in Daniel chapter 3 after the fiery furnace incident. Whoa, your God is awesome. And there's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saying, I know, right? We told you that in the first place. When we told you to put that in your furnace and smoke it, and you decided to roast us anyway. We told you that. And so he's like, yeah, their God is so cool. If anyone says anything against them, I will have them cut into pieces and their houses turned into piles of rubble. So again, I do not recommend that as an altar call. But verse 6, if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me. So this is a classic win-lose situation. They have to not only give the right interpretation of the dream, they have to divine somehow what the dream was. That's going to make their jobs infinitely more difficult. And Nebuchadnezzar says, I have firmly decided. So their blood pressure is going up. Ooh, right? They're starting to get a little bit nervous. They know he's not joking around. And they're thinking, boy, if one of us can pull this off, we are set. Verse 7, once more they replied, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will interpret it. Come on, man. Just throw us a bone. Please tell us what you dreamt. The king answered, I am certain that you're trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there's only one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me. Here's what I think is happening. Here's what I think is happening. And this is implied in the passage. And if I'm wrong, that's okay. I think he's probably has visions and dreams on a regular basis, right? Most of us do. And he probably thinks, well, that was weird. You know, I ate too much whatever, and that was not cool. But sometimes he believes his dreams have meaning, and so he calls in his advisors, his royal wizards. I think they make stuff up. I do. I think they're making stuff up. Because look how flattering they are. Oh, may the king live forever. You know, so he's like, yeah, I had this dream. And I was in this dream, and I dreamed that I was riding on a narwhal with a saddle on it. It's like the unicorn of the sea, right? A narwhal, and it came up out of the sea, and I was screaming a victory cry, and the narwhal did battle with a unicorn. And there were sparks and rainbows and glitter everywhere. Do you guys think that means something? And they would say, yeah, it means you're the greatest king ever. And it also means we're going out for Frosties. Yeah, that sounds good. Get in the van. And so, you know, they go out. And so I think he's sick and tired of them making stuff up. And he's calling them on it. You guys have been tricking me. And I have educated you. I have protected you. I have fed you. I have clothed you. I've spent a lot of resources on you. I need better than this. You will tell me the dream or you will die a fantastically gruesome death. Verse 10. For those of you who mark, highlight, or underline in your Bibles, here we go. The astrologers answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks." Stop there. There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. True or false? Are they right or wrong? All right, would you like to do raised hands to see what everybody else is saying? How many of you say, I agree with them? Come on. Come on, nice and high. Okay? How many of you say, no, they're wrong? Nice and high. I actually think they're right. Right? I know what you're thinking. You're like, well, Daniel does. Right? Don't read ahead. Stop it. Daniel does. Is it Daniel? That is right. Let's finish up this thought. The astrologers answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer." And I really believe they know what they're talking about. They've studied history. They know. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans. Verse 11 again. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they are not here. They don't live among us. That statement is really interesting to unpack, I think, this narrative and where it is going. Even though we know where it's going, let's just pretend like we're going to enjoy the ride anyway, right? Even though we know where it is going. So what they're saying is, King, we are going to rely on our reason to tell you the meaning of your dream. You tell us, and we're going to use our reason to figure it out. Or at least make something up. Which requires a modicum of reason. Okay? They also demonstrate in their statement that they believe in the supernatural. They really do believe in the supernatural. The Mesopotamians, the Babylonians in this case, are extremely religious. Much like the Athens that we looked at on Sunday morning. They are extremely religious, but what they're also demonstrating is that they have no access to the supernatural world. None. Now, I think it was yesterday, all the days are running together. I told you this was one giant sermon, so I'm confused of what I said what. But I think it was yesterday that I said that the Christian uses reason and trusts God, and the non-Christian trusts reason and uses God. Okay? Let's talk about the difference between reason and revelation. Because I do think a mistake is made, and it's a grave error, among well-meaning, well-intended Christians, that we seem to think that reason is not godly. Well, if that's the case, then Jesus should have never said we should love God with all our mind. So, let's talk about this difference between reason and revelation. So, if you made a simple observation about me, and you're bored with what I'm saying, like, I'm just going to look at what he's wearing, because I'm tired of what he's saying. And you look at my left hand. What is an observation you make of my left hand? There's you can't really see it, but it's a relatively plain band. It's got some kind of Lord of the Rings type thing. No, it's not the Ring of Power, if you're wondering. I can't put that on my finger. That's wrong. I disappear. My nerd friend, that was just for you, Jennifer. Yeah. All right. So, it is made of tungsten, which is also known as wolfram, my favorite element, because it's got the word wolf in it. And it's not really got much on it. Now, using your reason alone, you can figure out that a man with a plain metal band on the ring finger of his left hand generally indicates what? I'm married, right? Now, could there be other reasons that I have a plain metal band on the ring finger of my left hand? Well, perhaps a grandfather or father has passed away, and in his memory I wear his wedding band, or, you know, something. It could be something like that. That would be far more uncommon than common, right? So just by using your reason, you can figure that out. So knowing that this is Emmanuel Baptist Church and I've been asked to speak at Family Bible Week, you can assume that I'm married to a woman, right? Also, that she's not mine. We're just friends. Mine's home. Her name's Becky. So anyway, so you could, lost my train of thought. Yeah, I'm married to Becky. That's right. So I'm married to Becky. And so you'd figure out, well, he's married, and so he's married to a woman, or perhaps, you know, you probably would assume she's still living. But at some point, I was and am married. Now, reason is used to figure that out in this case, correct? Let us equate that then to what we would call general revelation. Natural philosophy. Natural theology. I hear the sound of war in the camp. Did you guys hear that? Okay. All right. So you all heard that too? That wasn't just me? All right, because that scares me sometimes. All right. So, making simple observations, there are things about me that you can know. Right? Now, beyond that, can you make a simple observation looking at me and know that I have children? Now, if you say it's because you don't have any hair, we're not going to be friends any longer. Or if you say because you have a gray beard, we're not going to be friends. No. Right? You cannot make a simple observation to know that. The only way you can know that, if I reveal it to you. Revelation. Which, for the purposes of this conversation, we will compare to special revelation. General revelation tells us some things about human nature. It tells us some things about the law of nature that we can apply to humanity. And I do not have time to list the details of what those are. According to Romans 1, as we've referenced multiple times, but it's kind of a big deal. According to Romans 1, that the natural order can actually tell us something about God's divine attributes. Some of it. Special revelation goes beyond that. It tells us more fully about who we are, and it tells us more about who God is. Does special revelation tell us everything about God? No. It does not tell us everything about God, and it probably tells us more than we can actually fully comprehend. At least I can't. But this is the difference between reason and revelation. But the way that you can understand the revelation is using your reason. They don't cancel each other out. One doesn't fight against the other. They're friends. And these guys understand that there is That there is a spiritual world, but they have no access to it because they have not accessed the revelation. And they are very spiritual. They believe in gods that exist in their world of thinking, in their worldview, their pantheon of ideas, but they've never spoken to them. And they're being really unwittingly, and Nebuchadnezzar doesn't understand what he's doing either. He's pushing them back in their worldview, and they're stuck. These are the best of the best. I've had a dream. It deeply troubles me. I can't figure out what it means. Tell us what you dreamt. Not this time. This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. All right, you're done. I'm going to get new ones. I have a vast empire. I can wait it out, train more. You guys are dead. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. Now, a reasonable question would be, how come they didn't get called in that day? Reasonable question. Well, maybe it was their day off from their work study program, right? It's the second year, right? So they're senior-ish. They're getting there, or they were doing what all college students were doing, at least what I was doing when I wasn't studying, and they were playing ping pong. So either way, they're not on duty that day, but they are part of the wizard class. So the death sentence applies to them too. Verse 14, when Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death, Arioch, by the way, is the head of campus security. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. Now, he may be still a young teenager, if our date's right. He's a young man. Right, so whether he's a teenager in his early 20s is really irrelevant. But he's still a young man. This is the guy with his friends who said, we're not going to eat the food and drink the wine. Test us for 10 days. So here he is, Mr. Salad Bar. He's already known to the officials. He's known by Nebuchadnezzar personally. Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? What is going on? I mean, I got the memo here. What is the deal? Why are you coming after me with a death sentence? Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went to the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. Again, let us not lose the shock and awe of this narrative. He approaches Arioch with wisdom and tact. Not like a whiny 20-year-old who's claiming fairness or whatever. Equal rights. He has none. In the Babylonian Empire, he's more or less a valuable property that Nebuchadnezzar has invested in. So Arioch comes to him. I think we can infer from the text that Arioch and Daniel had some kind of prior familiarity. So they have this conversation, and he speaks to him with wisdom and tact. And then Daniel takes his life into his hands again and goes to the king himself. This is not going to your state representative's office somewhere in Marathon County. This is the most powerful man on the planet. And he goes in and he says, I want some time. Maybe I can interpret the dream. So look at what happens next. And we're going to end this part with verse 18. And if we get done a little early for break, that's okay, because we got a lot of ground to cover, believe it or not. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Ladies and gentlemen, what you have in front of you is the first recorded college prayer meeting. Isn't it amazing that their first line of defense is often our last? They get on their faces and they beg God for help. If this were today and we were dealing with college students, I can just imagine the conversation that's going on in their dorm room there at the University of Babylon. They come back, they hear what's going on, they rip off their name tags, Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, they're throwing them off. I can't believe this is happening. This is so unfair. We need to do something. What do you think we should do? Mishael, ooh, I think we ought to create a Star of David picture and we'll put it over our Facebook profile picture and we'll raise awareness. We will raise awareness with the rest of the captives. Yes, let's do that. Or maybe Azariah said, no, that's not going to get us anywhere. I know what we should do. Let's create some really scathing hashtags. Hashtag, not my despot. Hashtag, never Nebuchadnezzar. That'll do it. Let's do that. Ooh, let's transfer. Well, that's not really an option. Let's get out of here. Because this is not fair. They're not treating us very well. No, their first action is often our last line of defense. Oh, did you pray about it? I didn't think of that. And why did they pray? Because they have access to the supernatural. They have access. All right, we're going to take a break. It's a little early. But this is the best place to take a quick 5-minute stretch break. And we're going to come back and we're going to look at some very stark contrasts between the life of a Hebrew young man and a Mesopotamian young man. See you in a couple minutes. Okay. Now, I hope you like history, because you're going to get some. This is important to understand. Again, the comparisons and contrasts, especially that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah lived as they were in this extremely hostile environment. So let's talk about Babylon and what it was. Now, this is an artist's rendering of the city, but it would have been the greatest city in the ancient world. The greatest city in the ancient world. This would have been a place that would have blown these guys away. The technological advancements would have been stunning to them. One of the wonders of the ancient world that, again, no actual pictures have survived of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. One of the kings, it may have been Nebuchadnezzar, I can't remember right off the top of my head, built them for one of his wives who came from a more tropical climate and came to the desert there, a pretty arid climate in modern-day Iraq. And so he built these beautiful hanging gardens so she would feel more at home. Ladies, how's that sound? Nice? Good. All right, guys. Get on it. So they would have been struck by two things when they arrived at the city in 605 B.C., they would have been struck by the technological advancements, number one, and number two, the near total idolatry that was in the city. Kind of in the top center of that picture there, that would be the artist's rendition of a ziggurat. And that, no, that's not something that comes in packs when you smoke, spelled with a Z. A ziggurat. That would probably be Marduk's temple. So, as they walked into the city, they would have seen that they had libraries and schools dedicated to studying cosmology, pharmacology, astronomy, astrology, history, literature, and they were all connected and interconnected with the temples. They would have soon realized what I told you the other day, that all their temples had their priests and priestesses. And the temples were built in such a way that each one had an image of whatever particular god it inhabited, if you will. That temple had its own bedchamber, and the priests and priestesses' job was to bring them food, water, change their clothes, change their linens, do all that stuff for them. The city revolved around that, and these guys would have probably been overwhelmed. They had never seen anything like it before. Now, Jerusalem, yes or no, was in decline in 605 BC, spiritually speaking. Yes. So that's why it happened, and not all that many years later, it was destroyed in 586. So they had some knowledge of what idolatry looks like, but on this scale, I want you to think of the average, perhaps, Christian school kid, me, who had very few friends outside of my youth group / Christian school sphere. Very few. In fact, as I told you, I had nobody in my youth group who I did not go to school with. Christian school that had, it was closed enrollment. You had to sign the doctrinal statement, which they beat us with regularly. So it was that kind of environment. It would be like me, and I grew up in a world that said, good kids go to Bible college, wild kids go to Cedarville. Or Liberty, whatever. And kids who don't care about God at all go to University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we were taught that if you step foot on a campus like that, you would immediately burst into flames. It would be like me graduating from high school. Now, I went to community college, but so did half of my class. The community college in upstate New York. So I was with the same people I had been with the past 14 years, from pre-K all the way up through 12th grade. It'd be like me going to Penn State main campus all alone. Imagine how overwhelmed I would have felt. And people ask me sometimes about my educational choices. Well, academically speaking, I've committed academic suicide because I have 3 degrees from the same school. And that's okay in God's providence. It really is. But I think, man, if I really knew what God was going to have me do, instead of doing what I did, I would have maybe gone to Pitt, University of Pittsburgh, and double majored in classics and philosophy. And if I had done that, I would be a casualty today. I would have been completely unprepared. Completely unprepared. I would have held on by sheer will for about a week. And I would have stopped daring to be a Daniel really fast. So just imagine the atmosphere. Not to mention the physical structure of the building. Now again, this is from Herodotus, and he tends to make stuff up. But Herodotus tells us that the walls of the city were 80 feet thick. Okay? That's 30 feet. I just walked about 30 feet. About 3, right? 10 strides, 3 feet to a stride. Is my math right? Because I did go to Bible college. All right. So that's a little more than a third. How thick the walls were. The walls were also 320 feet high. No, there's no getting through them, over them. That's why the Persians walked in. Again, you can see the Euphrates snaking through the river. They diverted it. They just walked in under the gates. And the circumference of the city walls is 56 miles. What would you do? You're a teenager. By yourself. Pretty much. Just you and your friends. Not like me at community college where I go home and I have a youth pastor that's going to beat some religion into me if I'm going wayward. They don't have that. What would you do? I want to, for a timeline of history, I want to help you see what is happening in history. So there are some dates and names that I want you to know. Biblical scholars basically think that Abraham was born in 2000 BC, 4,000 years ago. Epic of Gilgamesh. The Epic of Gilgamesh, a book that we are going to spend some time thinking about. Anybody ever have to read that? High school? Have to or want to? Okay. We'll go with that answer. The Epic of Gilgamesh, which you're going to see is really important. The first known copies date to 2000 BC. Uruk was ruled by Gilgamesh 600 years before that. The city of Uruk. Do you know who's from the neighborhood of Uruk, like in the same county? Abraham. The Enuma Elish, another book. That's a book. That's not a person, by the way. That's a book. Was written around 1500 BC. Hesiod's Theogony. Hesiod is the name of the author. Theogony is the name of the book. Hesiod's Theogony was composed around 700 BC, and then probably of all these, the one that you'd be most familiar with, at least by name, is Homer's Iliad, 750 BC. So, all these things had come before Daniel arriving in Babylon in 605 BC at about 15 years of age, and Jerusalem is destroyed in 586. Right? Just to give you an idea of some of the history and what is happening there. All right, let's take a guided tour. So, unless Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and the rest of the tributes who are taken from Jerusalem to Babylon, unless they're different from everybody else, which I do not think they were, when they got to the University of Babylon, they would have been taken through the Ishtar Gate, which is depicted on your left. Again, it has not survived antiquity, and that is a reconstruction thereof, and it's not really all that fair. It's to scale. You can see the person in the lower right-hand corner. Those walls are not 300 some feet tall. But they would have been brought through the Ishtar Gate. Ishtar is the chief goddess of the Babylonian pantheon. She is a chief goddess of the Babylonian pantheon, and she's a really nice gal. her special deal is war and sex. Okay? So she is the chief goddess of the Babylonian pantheon, and she had her own gate, the Ishtar Gate. The Ishtar Gate had these blue porcelain tiles that were emblazoned with griffins, flying lions, and other creatures, dragons and stuff was on there, and archaeology has shown us over and over again that just about every brick had Nebuchadnezzar's name written on it. Kind of what Saddam Hussein tried to do centuries later. Thought he was Nebuchadnezzar. Let you figure out who ended better. So they were brought through the Ishtar Gate. And they were brought through the Ishtar Gate on purpose. Why? Because their new masters wanted to wow them. How many of you have ever been on an official college tour? Do you think there's a rhyme and reason? How many of you have ever been on an official college tour in anything but a Christian university? Okay. Do you think there's a plan? Or do you think they just willy-nilly, well, let's look in this room and see what we find. Oh, look, a sea of red Solo cups awash in a foam of beer. No, they know what they're doing, and they have a plan where they want to take you. To your right is an actual picture of the University of Scranton that I took myself. The Ishtar Gate at the University of Scranton and the Ishtar Gate at the University of Babylon, not quite the same. But I will tell you, you can't see it in that picture, and I had to stop taking pictures because students are like, hey, weirdo, what are you doing? So I had to stop. But I can tell you that this central part of the university spent hundreds of thousands of dollars putting down new paving stones and putting in all kinds of new architecture, because when students come, they go through this gate. And they want them to see they're coming out of the city into a completely new atmosphere. And I have some former students that give tours, and I ask them about the things that they talk about, and they're very much trying to impress them, just like they would have done with Daniel and his friends. And they're trying to impress them. They're also trying to scare them into behaving. Because if you go through all the trouble to bring home a tribute and he acts up so bad that you got to kill him, well, it's kind of not worth your trouble, right? All right. When I visit a university, and I just did this past fall, I got to visit Marquette University. And that was like a bucket list thing for me because they have a Tolkien collection down there. They acquired in the 1950s, so they have the original handwritten autographs of The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, all kinds of stuff. So if you're into that stuff, off you go. And so I did that, and I had a buddy with me, lives in the Milwaukee area, and he said, well, what else do you want to do? And I said, well, we have to go to the bookstore. We have to go to the bookstore. And I said, and it's going to feel weird, but just follow my lead. He's like, all right. So we get to the official Marquette bookstore. It's got some special name. I can't remember what it's called. And I'm not interested in all the Marquette hats and t-shirts and stuff, mainly because it's expensive and I would buy it if I could afford it. But I'm really interested. I want to get beyond that to the roped off sections, the actual textbook sections. And so at Marquette, I've spoken at other schools, Binghamton University. I've spoken at other state schools and private schools for Christian organizations that are not Christian schools. I always do the same thing. I go to the bookstore, and unless I'm there during like the first week of the semester, there's a section roped off, and I have to go to the clerk, and I say, would you mind if I just browse back there? And at Marquette, it was easy because I said, oh, I teach at a sister school, which they'd never heard of, in Scranton. But they're like, okay, weirdo. So they let me in. They let the tape. I'm like, my buddy too. And they say, okay. And I go in and I spend time. I'll tell you the sections that I go to. I go to the literature section. I want to see what those students are being asked to read. What are they saying is English literature? I go to the philosophy section, of course. And I'm trying to get an idea of the flavor of what is being taught. Now, I could be wrong about how I guess things, because I have my students read stuff that I disagree with on purpose, but I'm just curious. But you get a sense of the weight of what is there. And I go to the religion section, and I want to see what's there as well. Well, the University of Babylon had its own bookstore, kind of. Cuneiform tablet store. And I want to talk about what I think these guys read. Now, I could be wrong about this, and you say, Andy, did you get any of this from the Bible? No. I got this from my study of Mesopotamian history that I spent weeks doing a year ago. And I could be wrong. I don't think I am. But I want to help you understand what they looked at, and I want you also to see that these ideas are still with us 4,000 years later. First book, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Remember, we said that the first known copies have been dated to the same year-ish Abraham was born and deal with events and a particular person that Abraham would have been in least physical close proximity to. He didn't know him. But this is the story of a guy named Gilgamesh. It is the Mesopotamian hero epic. I would bet I would go all in on the first two, that Daniel and his friends studied these. The second two, maybe not. But I'm pretty sure that they would have studied these. And here's the story of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh was a great ruler. And he was kind of a tough guy. Nobody really liked him. And he didn't really have friends. And so the gods decided that Gilgamesh needed a buddy. So they made one. His name is Enkidu. I introduced you to him the other day. So his name is Enkidu, and Gilgamesh and Enkidu, that could be a song. I'm not going to do it. The Gilgamesh and Enkidu go off and they have all kinds of adventures. They go to Lebanon and they strike down the sacred cedars of Lebanon. They kill an ogre. I mean, who wouldn't if you're out running around doing stuff? And Gilgamesh realized something about himself. He found out about himself. He said, I'm mortal. And I'm going to die. And I need to discover the secret to immortality, because when I die, my afterlife, which they all believed in, they were extremely spiritual, they were not godly. When I die, my afterlife is going to be terrible. So I've got to figure out a way to survive, to live on for as long as I can, and I'm going to seek immortality. So he goes on an epic quest. And he goes to the ends of the earth, and you know who he talks to at the ends of the earth? The survivor of the global flood. Epic of Gilgamesh. Now, his name is not Noah. And he gets all the way there. He's like, oh, you survived the flood, man. How did you do that? And he's like, well, the gods actually tried to wipe out humanity, is what the Noahic figure in the Epic of Gilgamesh tells him. The gods wanted to wipe out humanity, and Gilgamesh knew why. Because they don't like humanity. They got sick of it. But one of them came to Gilgamesh, or came to the Noahic figure, and gave him the secret. Said, build a boat. Because we've tried killing them with disease, we've tried killing them with famine, this time we're going to wash them off the face of the earth, build a boat, because I don't want to get my own lemonade. We need your species to survive. So Gilgamesh says, oh, the gods had mercy on you. No, the gods didn't have mercy on us. They need us to do stuff for them. Oh. Well, how do I have eternal life? You don't. Sorry. You came all this way. We have some parting gifts on your way out. So Gilgamesh is given this prophecy from the, and his name is not pronounceable, I'm sorry, from the Noahic figure in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and tells him, well, listen, you're going to die, so what you need to do is you need to make a name for yourself now. You make a name for yourself now, and it's going to echo throughout history. And many of you have heard of Gilgamesh. May not know what it is. That's okay. And so he goes back and he makes a great name for himself. He builds a great city, Uruk. And he builds up its walls. He builds up its fortifications. And he rules with an iron fist. And he dies. Keep that in mind. Hero epic. Next book over, the Enuma Elish. This is the Mesopotamian creation myth. Mesopotamian creation myth, wherein there are gods, plural, male and female, and there are gods who reign above the earth and heaven, and there are gods who reign in the underworld. Okay? And there's an explanation of how the gods became gods, who they had to eat, who they had to impale, who they had to kick out, who they had to kill, who they had to murder, and how they made stuff. And there was really one of two ways that they made stuff. Either by procreation, or they had a little creation kit. They open stuff up and they had stuff in there, but they had pre-existing material to work with. And the story goes on about how they didn't get along and all kinds of intrigue and all that kind of stuff. If you're wondering, is there any equivalent that I would know of? Yes. If you've ever seen whether the really cheesy 80s version or the slightly updated version of the movie Clash of the Titans, that's it. Then right next to that is Theogony by a dude named Hesiod. Theogony is the Greek creation myth. You know what? It's the same story. Different names, exact same story. I studied this in grad school. It's about how the gods became gods, what they did with the Titans, who became chief and why, and how they either created using procreation or existing material. Oh, and by the way, in both cases, they made man flawed so that he would continually die off so a new crop would come up every time. Made man flawed. The greatest equivalent to Hesiod and the Enuma Elish is probably, in our contemporary thinking, is not Clash of the Titans, but it is the Marvel comic universe or DC Comics. Think about it. Superman is Zeus. Wonder Woman is Athena. Aquaman, that's easy. Poseidon. Batman might be Hades. I'm not really sure. And the MCU universe, it's the same thing. Who's the great villain in the MCU universe, the Marvel Comics universe? Where is he from? Thanos, his name is Thanos. He's from Titan. He's a Titan. Clash of the Titans. 4,000 years later, man still telling the same story. Lastly, the Iliad by Homer. Iliad is can be compared to Gilgamesh, interestingly, because it, again, tells the same story. This time, a little bit different, but it's the same idea. We were introduced to this character on our first night when we did our little exercise in exegesis, and I showed you that Iliad is a cheesed-off mama's boy. We saw that in the opening lines, and he's this great warrior. And he quits. The story of Iliad takes place in about 2 weeks near the end of the 10-year siege of Greece, the Greek army sailing across the Aegean and laying siege to Troy. And why, by the way? All because of a man and woman's insatiable lust. Paris of Troy and Helen of Sparta. And historically, this may have actually really happened. So there they are, and they're putting the beat down on the Trojans, and the leader of everybody, the Greeks, Agamemnon, calls a council, and he says, it's not fair. Achilles' war bride is prettier than mine. I'm in charge. I'm going to take her. And so Achilles quits, and he goes to his tent. He says, that's it. And he prays to his mother, his goddess mother. He is a demigod. He is half human, half god, just like Gilgamesh. And he prays to his goddess mother. Her name is Thetis. And she says, hey, Zeus owes you a favor. I'm so mad at my fellow Greeks. I want you to ask Zeus to strike them down. And she says, okay. So she goes to Zeus, and she wraps her hands around his knees and lays her head in his lap. She says, hey, you owe me one, because remember, I saved you from drowning that one time. Oh, yeah. So, you know, my son, he's got it really bad, so I want you to crush the Greeks. All right. So he starts letting the Trojans win, and then his wife/sister, Hera, seduces him and gets him to change his mind. So in both Gilgamesh and in Iliad, you see the gods changing their minds all the time. I didn't bother telling you that Ishtar tries to seduce Gilgamesh in that book, and all kinds of other crazy stuff is happening. And Achilles is a quitter until his best friend is killed, Patroclus, by the Trojan warrior Hector, and he's like, all right, that's it. He puts on his armor, and he goes, and he kills Hector. And every time I read the story, I root for Hector, because he's the only one with any kind of character in the whole story. But here's the thing about Achilles. He knows the prophecy. Either he can live on in anonymity, die an old man, or he can win glory for his name now and have his name live on and on and on. And who in this room has never heard the name Achilles? These are the Mesopotamian ideals. Make a name for yourself now. A little bit different than the Hebrew mindset. Would you not agree? Okay, I got a bunch of stuff. If you're trying to take notes, do not try to write all this down. There's more. Okay. I want to look at the difference between, again, in a slightly different way, between the Mesopotamian mind and the Hebrew mind. Just to put ourselves into Daniel's position as he receives the word that his life is now on the line again. And not for the last time. So I'm going to reference some of these things. I'm not going to go through them in order in any way, because that would just take way too much time. But can't you picture Daniel, right? He's been in his wizardry classes all day, studying Gilgamesh, Enuma Elish, Assyrian writings, other things that are lost. You know, we don't even know. It's lunchtime. So here he goes, off to the cafeteria at the University of Babylon, right? And he goes past the carved pork table, past the bacon cheeseburger table, and he goes right to the salad bar. No bacon bits, no ham slices, If there's turkey, no ranch dressing, right? He's got to be careful. There he is eating salad again. Okay, maybe he's not on the same lunch schedule as the other three. Here he is. And in my sanctified imagination, I can picture him having a conversation with another captive. Let's call him Andreas. That's my name in Greek. Let's call him Andreas, a Greek captive. And he's watching Daniel. And he wonders, what's this guy all about? He's not eating the pulled pork. So Daniel sits down, and Andreas sits down across from him. He's like, hey, Belteshazzar, I'm just curious. What's your deal? So Daniel puts down his fork, and he looks up, and he makes eye contact with Andreas. He said, that's a great question. And Andreas said, well, you know, I see your name tag, Belteshazzar. May Marduk protect him. Awesome. But I've heard your friends refer to you as Daniel. What does that mean? That is a strange name to my ears. Daniel, what does that mean? I can see Daniel getting a little smirk on his face. Looking up at this guy and saying, God is my judge. His face would have went white with fear. You must live in complete anxiety. You must live in abject fear to think that God is your judge. Do you know what's going to happen to you in the underworld? Because in the Mesopotamian mind, you make a name for yourself now so you can avoid death as long as you can, because in the afterlife, there is nothing. Well, that's not true. There's something. You get to feast on clay and dirt for eternity, being shoved down your throat by the gods of the underworld. And it's only levels of how bad can it be, depending on how good you live in this life. Some things haven't changed for what people think. The afterlife is going to be that my afterlife depends on me now. He would say, you must live in so much fear to know that God will be your judge. And Daniel would say, no, I welcome his judgment. For I walk with him, not against him, not away from him, with him. Why do you think I'm eating salad, man? And he would say, tell me, Daniel, what do you believe about the gods? Well, I'm studying what you're studying, but I have a much different view about the gods. Oh, like what? Well, Daniel would say, well, first of all, Andreas, you and everybody else seems to think that the gods made humans flawed. I'll tell you what I know, that the God of my fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, did not make us flawed. In fact, in the beginning, after he made man, he said that we were very good. Our own state is our own fault. God didn't make us this way. We did it in rebellion. But God did not give up on us. And furthermore, your gods believe that they had to have some kind of pre-existing material to make everything. Do you know how Yahweh made stuff? He spoke it into existence. Your story, Andreas, is the God's story. It's amazing how similar they are, because just like humans are fickle and they cannot make up your minds, it's amazing that the gods you say you believe in are just like you. My God is not like me. He's completely different. He's transcendent. You believe that your gods reside in idols. My God could never be contained in a rock. He made the rock. You say, Andreas, that you would do anything to avoid death. The righteous man welcomes death. I don't want to die, but it does not frighten me. Here are some things written, whether Daniel ever actually read them or not, I can't say for sure, but the oral tradition would have been very, very strong in his day. Let me talk to you about some things that Daniel knew. God cannot die. He is from everlasting to everlasting. Psalm 90, verse 2. The Babylonians believed their gods could be killed. They would not die of natural causes, but they could kill one another and did so on a regular basis. Man's sorry state is his own fault, Genesis 2:17 and following. Daniel knew that. Death is a blessing because if man lived forever, he would live in sin forever. There would be no chance of redemption, Genesis 3:22. Psalm 139, 7 through 8. If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I go down to Sheol, you are there. Daniel understood there is one God of both life and death. Not gods above the earth and gods under. There is one. And he knew that God would hold his right hand to be with him and he will take him into glory. Psalm 73, 24 through 26. Let's come back to the text, verse 17 of chapter 2. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery so that he and his friends may not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. They are concerned, yes, for their own lives, but for their pagan classmates. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision, and then Daniel praised God of heaven and said, now, if you can picture things in your mind better by listening than by reading, I invite you to close your eyes and just listen. Listen. Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are His. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. Listen to verse 22. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness and light dwells with him. As they walked into that city and they saw the dark and shadowy doors of the temples of the lifeless gods all over the city, it probably frightened them, it concerned them, it made them nervous, it made them scared. They didn't know what was in there. God does! Nothing is hidden from him. There's nothing hidden from you, God. You know it all. I thank and praise you, God of my ancestors. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king. Why that has not been put to music yet, I have no idea. Pastor Mike, write it. Run from the darkness. When the God of the universe, who is the maker of light, in him there is no darkness at all, says through his servant, you are light-bearing sources, Philippians chapter 2, which is different from what Jesus says in the Gospels. You are the light, you are phos. In Philippians chapter 2, you are phosteres, a light-bearing source. I know what it is in the darkness, and I want you to bring the light in there. You cannot do that when you run and hide. Verse 24. Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret the dream for him. Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dreams mean. Is Arioch risking his life now? Why? Maybe because Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. I'll tell you, the students that come to me and say, Andy, I've messed up. I wasn't managing my time. I'm going to be late on my paper. I'm far more apt to be merciful to them than those who come to me and say, well, you know, I'm an architecture major, and that program's way more important than your philosophy class. That's what I love to hear. Thank you. Off with his head. The king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, may Marduk protect him. Marduk isn't protecting nothing. Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it, stop. Don't read any further. What would you do if you're Daniel? Okay, you would have gotten word by now about the conversation that the other wizards had had with the king. No man on the planet can do what the king asks. No king has ever asked his servants to do this. It is impossible. Now here you are, standing before the king, and he asks you, is it true? You can tell me what the dream is and interpret it. What would you say? Yes, I can. I like my scholarship money, thank you very much. Verse 27, Daniel replied, no wise man, enchanter or magician or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you are lying in bed are these. And we're going no further in the text. Isn't that glorious? No man on earth can do what the king asks. But your majesty, you have forgotten something. My eyes are not drawn toward the earth, where I see only darkness, gloom, and despair. I know what I've been studying in the classroom that tells me that I should do everything to preserve my life. I've read it in your histories of both the creation myth and the hero epics, and what I'm about to do is completely antithetical to the Mesopotamian state of mind, but I also know that that is damning, and I will not do it. Instead, I serve the God of my forefathers, and I will do nothing else, and I will declare to you that He rules in heaven. It is He who knows what is hidden in secret and knows your dreams. And He has told me. Here's something else Daniel knew. As he's walking up the steps, I don't know if he's bounding up a couple at a time. All right, it's Nebuchadnezzar Day. Woohoo! I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know. But do you think he's going to see him? I hope I'm right. I hope I'm right. I hope I'm right. I hope I'm right. Oh, I got to believe more because I'm having doubt. And when I have doubt, I know I got to conjure inside of myself this feeling of belief because I don't feel like talking to Nebuchadnezzar. I don't feel like declaring there's a God in heaven. I don't feel like getting my head chopped off today. Maybe he was saying to himself something like this. I know that my Redeemer lives. Or Defender. And that in the end He will stand upon the earth after my skin has been destroyed. Yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see Him with my own eyes. I am not another. How my heart yearns within me. See, his Mesopotamian friends would have said, dude, the king's going to kill you, and when you die, your body will dissolve, and you're never going to get it back, and you're just going to be the shade that has to eat dirt in the shadows in the underworld forever. And Daniel said, no, there's a day when my flesh will be destroyed. I will see God. And if it is today, so be it. Just like in the next chapter, when his three friends refused to bow, before Nebuchadnezzar's megalomaniac project, while the rest of the Babylonian Empire is eating dust, and they get called forward, and Nebuchadnezzar says, I don't know who you guys think you are, but I'm going to give you one more chance. We have the ancient praise band. They're going to hit the power chord, and when you hear it, you better drop and worship me. If you don't, I'm going to throw you into the blazing furnace, and then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? And they answered him, go ahead. We will not bow down to you or your object of worship. And they said, the God that we serve is able to save us this day, but even if He does not, we will not bow. Ladies and gentlemen, it's one thing to claim a belief that God is behind human history. It is one thing to claim a belief that God is absolute and He has ordered the universe in a certain way that ought not to be tinkered with, changed, or altered. It is one thing to say that I believe that my identity comes from my fellowship with God through the finished work of Jesus Christ in the church age. It's another to say, oh yes, I have access to the supernatural. I have the written word. I have testimony. I pray to God. He answers my prayers. All that is good that you believe that. But do you know it? What if in our lifetime our cushy Bill of Rights is removed? We find ourselves under despotic reign. No longer do churches enjoy not only tax-free status, but what if we find ourselves like the believers who received the letter to the Hebrews and we are outlaws? And our job no longer is to just defend the truth of Christianity, but now we have to defend its goodness. Do you have access to the supernatural? Will you allow experience alone to be the arbiter of your reality? If you do, you will fail. You will fall. What is your name? When you're no longer Deacon Jones in Emmanuel Baptist Church, who's been serving since the earth was still cooling down, you're no longer the soccer coach, the homemaker, all the things that you've wrapped your identity in are taken from you. What is your name? Will we not just prepare our students as they're heading off to university, because these are all things they're going to face? What will we do? When we began the series the other night, I asked if any of us ever said to someone, usually in a children's teaching setting, dare to be a Daniel. Do you realize what you are asking? Are we preparing them? I'm going to ask you to bow your heads and close your eyes. Don't worry, I'm not going to give an invitation. I know you're getting nervous right now. Don't worry. Pastor Mike isn't up here, and you can't do one without a, you know, background music. Anyway. So just bow your heads and close your eyes, and we're going to get ready to close. And Pastor Rob's going to come up in a minute to close us out in prayer. But perhaps this isn't a come-forward invitation, but I am going to invite you to respond. Do you live your life like God is in charge or like you're in charge? Are you more concerned with your online presence and identity than your redemptive status with the one who cannot just kill body, but can kill body and soul? It's pretty important. Do you access the supernatural because God is your cosmic ATM? Do you understand the true nature of being set apart, a holy people, a royal priesthood? Do you know? Perhaps in the next few minutes you can reaffirm your commitment to God. Perhaps even some of you need to make a confession. Ask God to forgive you. Make this a fresh start.